on the Rehnquist thing, the political mileage basically is the same kind of mileage if we were to go with Smith. The idea being that we are appointing a highly qualified man. That's really what it gets down to.
I believe that that will...
And also, he doesn't quite have the smack of the corporate lawyer as much as Smith.
That's... No, he's more of a general practitioner.
But your judgment on it is worth thing. You raised it, and I just been thinking about it.
Well,
people all think so highly of the guy, he must have a hell of a lot on the ball.
Oh, he's got tremendous legal mind, Mr. President. There's no question about it. And just as solid as can be.
Yeah.
He's made a tremendous impression upon the judiciary around here and people on the Hill and the ones in the bar he's dealt with.
Incidentally, what is Rehnquist? I suppose he's a damn Protestant.
I'm sure of that.
That's too bad.
He's waspish as waspish can be.
Well, that's too damn bad. Tell him to change his religion.
Right. Get him baptized this afternoon.
Well, baptized and castrated. No, they don't do that. I mean, they circumcised. No, that's the Jews. Well, anyway, whatever he is, get him changed.
30 years ago, on October 21st, 1971, President Richard Nixon announced two nominees to the U.S. Supreme Court. There were a number of remarkable aspects to that announcement, but probably the most remarkable was that until that morning, President Nixon didn't know who he was going to nominate. It turned out to be Lewis Powell and William Rehnquist, the latter of which is today the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. How it turned out that way is the subject of our conversation during this hour of Focus 580. Our guide to the story is someone who should know it quite well. John Dean served as counsel to the president during the years in question, White House counsel, that is. You may remember his televised testimony during the Watergate hearings. He is the author of two books on the Nixon years, Blind Ambition and Lost Honor. So if you're among the generations for whom Watergate is ancient history, you might look for those as well. During this hour, we'll talk with John Dean about his latest book, The Rehnquist Choice, the untold story of the Nixon appointment that redefined the Supreme Court, just published by the Free Press. Published at the same time is a 5-CD audio version of the book, which includes some pretty interesting White House recordings of the president and the other people involved in the story, part of which we just heard. As we talk during this hour with John Dean about this story, you are invited into the conversation. Your questions are important, and you can call us around Champaign-Urbana at 333-9455. That's 333-WILL if you match the letters with the numbers. We also have a toll-free line anywhere you hear us around Illinois, Indiana, parts of the other states our signal travels, or via the internet anywhere else. 800-222-9455. Again, locally, 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. John Dean, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks so much for joining us.
Pleasure. Delight to hear you use the tapes.
Right.
I think that's the first time I'm aware of they've been broadcast.
Okay. Well, we may select some more parts of those to play as we talk. But just to get going, your book is pretty unprecedented in recounting the details of the politics and intrigue behind the appointment of Supreme Court justices in the Nixon administration. Why is it important for you to tell this story?
Well, I was there, of course, but I didn't know the entire story. And I didn't know the entire story until I went to the archives last fall. And that was when they had released the last batch of the Nixon tapes, a slice of which you just played, that really cover the 34-day period in which Nixon filled the two vacancies he was confronted with in the fall of 1971. And as I listened to the tapes, I realized, I said, you know, this is an amazing story. First, it's sort of a three-part drama, or a three-act drama, with some comedy in it, if you will. And also, it's an opportunity to take people inside the White House in a way they never have been before and probably never will be again, and to see a process that has gone on for 200 years is going to go on for a lot more years because as long as there's a Supreme Court, we're going to be having presidents select justices, and this is a chance to really look at how they do it, because it doesn't vary very much from president to president. So that's why I wrote the book.
Sure. There's one other aspect, though, that involves you, and we don't want to get too ahead of ourselves, but you had a key role in sort of presenting the possibility of William Rehnquist as a candidate.
I did indeed. Actually, my initial candidate was a man by the name of Richard Poff, who had been a Virginia congressman. And I tell the story, that's Act One, is the story of why Dick Poff didn't end up on the Supreme Court, because he really had a lock on the seat. And it's a story that I thought needed to be told, because it's a unique story amongst politicians where his own ambition he set aside for the benefit of his family. And it was a rather selfless act that he withdrew to protect a son who had been adopted, yet with an ironic twist at the end where that fact would come out. So I thought that story needed to be told.
Yeah.
And actually, I just had a letter from Dick Poff, who is it did become a justice, but not on the United States Supreme Court. He is a senior justice at this point on the Supreme Court of Virginia.
Mm-hmm. Well, we will talk more about that and your involvement in it, but maybe backing up a little bit, let's talk about some of the initial stories involved. You describe how Richard Nixon sought to change the composition of the U.S. Supreme Court even before he became president.
That's correct. What I thought I had to do for the reader is to give them what I call the backstory and what happened before these two vacancies opened up. And I tell the story how it really started in as early as 1968 during the 68 campaign, when the fine hand of Richard Nixon really was very involved in preventing Abe Fortas, who was a sitting justice who'd been nominated to be Chief Justice by President Johnson, to fulfill the seat of Earl Warren, who was Chief Justice and was retiring, how Nixon was very involved in blocking the confirmation of Fortas to become Chief Justice. And then that left him with a seat that he would be able to fill as president. This all happened, as I say, during the campaign, during the waning months of the campaign. It was clear that Earl Warren had retired from the court because he realized that Nixon was going to win, and Nixon had been out criticizing the Warren court. Not Warren directly, but certainly the decisions of the Warren court. So Warren thought, you know, obviously Nixon is not going to perpetuate what I've tried to do here, and thought he ought to get off while Johnson still had a chance.
Right.
It didn't work that way, though. Nixon actually encouraged a filibuster, and it was the first time a filibuster had ever occurred to block the nomination of a justice of the Supreme Court. There hasn't been one since 68, and the Republicans really launched the first one, and it did block Fortas.
Block Fortas from becoming Chief Justice, and that was followed by his resignation
from the
court.
Another part of the story, right?
Right.
What I describe in the introductory material is really Nixon's effort to unpack the court, if you will, rather than pack the court. He was trying to make seats available for justices who had his philosophy, and when he did assume office, the first thing he did is fill he had about 6 months to fill the seat that Earl Warren had vacated, and the first appointment was somewhat non-controversial, and that was to the Chief Justice, and that was filled by Warren Burger, who was a sitting Court of Appeals judge and was fairly well respected and really not. He was somewhat of a centrist, so he didn't make a lot of waves, and that was done very easily and swiftly. But Fortas was still on the court, and there was a rumor in Washington that he may have accepted some money from a foundation of a man who was under investigation. So that investigation was taken very seriously by the Nixon Justice Department. And indeed, as I tell in the book, there's an interesting story of little-known activity by Bill Rehnquist giving John Mitchell as Attorney General the sort of the legal basis upon which to investigate Fortas, and then ultimately to really bluff him off the court.
Let's talk a little bit more about that. What was William Rehnquist's position at this time, and what did he actually do to sort of equip John Mitchell with the ammo that he needed to sort of essentially, you know, force or at least bluff Fortas off the court?
The position that Rehnquist held was the Assistant Attorney General in charge of the Office of Legal Counsel. That is the post in the Justice Department that provides the legal opinions for the attorney general. It's sort of the often considered to be the attorney general's own lawyer or a little law firm within the in the Department of Justice, for particularly for constitutional issues. And Bill Rehnquist had been a law clerk, and Mitchell, not being a Washington type, really did look to Rehnquist when this issue came up as to whether they could investigate Fortas. And Rehnquist searched through old precedents, because there really was no precedent. The traditional role of the Department of Justice is to wait for the Congress to act, which has the only constitutional authority to remove somebody from the Supreme Court, and that is under the impeachment clause. So they were really reaching and searching, and as I explain in the book, the documents, the key documents from this period, have not reached the National Archives yet. They're fairly conspicuously missing. But I was able to find a contemporaneous interview that Rehnquist and Mitchell had done with a journalist who had no idea what really was going on, because there was no reason to be suspect of anything at the time. He was just trying to recount how Fortas had been removed, or why he, you know, the whole story, and in the course of doing it, had interviewed both Mitchell and Rehnquist and put together some of the basic facts. And those facts show the memo, or the legal theory that Rehnquist came up with that justified Mitchell investigating the sitting justice. And I find it to be thin at best, and very dubious precedent. I mentioned some of it in the book. A nice law journal article could be written on the subject of how there is virtually no authority for doing what they did.
Let's emphasize the unprecedented nature of this. The Justice Department had never gotten involved in investigating or trying to remove a Supreme Court justice in the past.
That is correct. It had only been the role of the Congress before, because under the Constitution, and certainly the founders seemed to have the impression that the only route to remove a justice was to go through the impeachment route, and the institutional wisdom of the Justice Department had always stayed out of this area and been very careful with any sitting, what they call Article III judge. Article III being the article in the Constitution that creates the federal judiciary. And the one memo I cite that Rehnquist relied on, I didn't get into this in the book, but why I say to make a nice law journal article, is he cites a precedent for an investigation of a sitting federal judge who was not an Article III judge, but rather he was he had been created by the Congress for one of the territories, the Northwest Territory, back in the late 18th century. And so he went all the way back for this precedent, and it really wasn't a true precedent. And that's why I say it's fairly dubious. And frankly, I was quite surprised that Rehnquist even undertook this, and he worked on a worst-case scenario where he assumed the worst-case set of facts he could assume as being true. Could the Department of go forward? Well, that seems to me a great leap right off, that you assume the worst rather than giving a sitting justice the benefit of the doubt before you decide if you can even investigate him.
Sure. Well, it wasn't just this legal work and the investigation that they undertook on this, but as is the case in many hardball politics sort of scenarios, there were leaks that got out about this, and people started talking about it, and Fortas felt mortified.
Well, he did. And that combined with the leaks that were... it's always very hard to say they were, you know, who did them, but I have a pretty good idea where they were coming from, and they were orchestrated right out of the department or out of the FBI, one of the two. And they were designed to put the pressure on Fortas. And in addition to that, Mitchell, another hardball act, was to convene a grand jury to investigate Fortas's wife, who was a tax lawyer in Washington, and his former law partner, on an issue that had been put to bed many years earlier. And it was designed just to do nothing but put pressure on them. We're well aware of Nixon's abuses of power in other areas, and no one has seemed to connect the dots before and put them to include this effort to unpack the court, which I have done.
So the net result was Because of this pressure, Fortas resigned the Supreme Court.
He did. It was quite remarkable that that the bluff was so good, and that none of Fortas's colleagues, who would theoretically be the finest legal minds we have in the country, so much as raised a finger to assist him or to counsel him to fight it. There's conflicting reports as to whether William O. Douglas, who was one of his friends and colleagues, did or did not. He was out of town most of the time, and it's been written up two ways. One is that he counseled he fight, because that's indeed what William Douglas himself would do later when they tried to remove him, and others have just said that he really didn't get into it. But when Fortas presented his situation to the conference of his colleagues, several of whom had similar arrangements where they had accepted fees for serving on foundations, and indeed the man Nixon would put on the court himself as Chief Justice, Warren Burger, had for years taken such fees from the Mayo Foundation. It was not an unusual practice. It just happened that this fellow Wolfson, whose foundation Fortas sat on, got in trouble with the SEC, and they tried to assume a worse case that Fortas had somehow tried to help Wolfson through with his problems, when in fact Wolfson himself had told the Department of Justice, after Mitchell had presented his bluff, that he had had no quid pro quo from Fortas. But Fortas, again, was worried, and the court was worried that there was going to be a lot of embarrassment for the court, and rather than cause any embarrassment, he just quietly left.
We're talking this morning with John Dean about his latest book, The Rehnquist Choice, The Untold Story of the Nixon Appointment That Redefined the Supreme Court. His previous books, Blind Ambition and, for some reason,
Lost Honor.
Thank you very much, Lost Honor. He's also a columnist for MSNBC.com and another popular legal website, Finley.com.
Fine Law.
Fine Law. I'm looking right at it. Okay, I'm looking at too
All
many
things. All right, I do the same thing.
Looking at too many things here. He's joining us by telephone to talk about the Rehnquist Choice, and those of you listening are welcome to join our conversation. The number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. After the Fortas nomination, Nixon had another empty seat to fill, and maybe we could talk a little bit about how he went about finding people to nominate, and there were several really badly botched attempts at this.
There were, and it's I don't think it's well known that the man who was running the radar machine to find future justices for the Supreme Court was William Rehnquist. Maybe that's one of the reasons that's one of the reasons he was never on anybody's radar screen, because he was running the radar machine. And he would look for candidates. Also, Warren Burger, who, this was one of the revelations, and there were many when I listened to the tapes and when I assembled the book. I, as you know, having read the book, I do it as dialogue rather than a book of transcripts, and it worked that way. I eliminated all the repetitive stuff and made it read more like a novel than a dissertation on selecting Supreme Court justices, because I found it a good story, too. But anyway, Rehnquist got a lot of the names in the list he kept of potential nominees from Burger, Warren Burger, and two of those names were a man by the name of Clement Haynsworth, who was a Fourth Circuit judge, and another one by the name of Harold Carswell. Both of these would be rejected by the Senate. The Haynsworth rejection was clearly a result of the Fortas treatment. The Senate, and it was controlled by the Democrats, they were upset with the way Fortas had been blocked to become Chief Justice, and even more upset with the fact that he had been forced to resign when it was pretty fuzzy and hazy as to why he was resigning. And people suspected the worst, and they were correct in doing so. That was really just a direct backlash, that they rejected Clement Haynsworth, who was totally qualified to be on the court. And Nixon, this was Nixon's effort to put a Southerner on the court, because the Fourth Circuit is in the South, and Clement Haynsworth was a man of came from a wealthy family, and he had a lot of potential conflicts, and one of them had come up while he had been on the Fourth Circuit, but had been cleared from it. But they used that at the Senate as a pretext to defeat him. And it was really very dubious whether it was a legitimate, but no more dubious than the basis that Fortas had been removed from the court.
Mm-hmm.
The next one, the Carswell nomination, was how it got through the vetting process by Rehnquist, I don't know. It would come out after the hearings were over, and Rehnquist had the job of reading a judge's opinions and making sure that he passed muster as Supreme Court quality. But what came out with Carswell was the fact that he was one of the most, if not the most, reversed lower federal judge in the United States. He'd served on the district court level for 12 years and had only been on the Court of Appeals for a very short while, and he'd been placed there because he'd been recommended by Warren Burger, the Chief Justice. And then he looked good on paper. He'd been a U.S. attorney, he'd been a federal district, one of the youngest federal district judges, and then he had just been elevated to the Fifth Circuit. So he looked good on paper, but in fact, it would prove he was not so good in fact. The Senate quickly developed information that the man might be a racist, and while I don't know that he is or was, there were certainly severe questions about his thoughtfulness on issues like that because of his statements, public statements, some of them just shortly before he'd been announced to be nominated. Another thing that while Richard Nixon was always looking for firsts, one first I don't think he was looking for was to place the first homosexual on the high court. And it appears that would have been Haynesworth, who, after this debacle was ended, the world would learn that he had been a homosexual for a number of years. And he got arrested in a mall in Tampa or Tallahassee, Florida, soliciting a vice officer, so there was no question about his proclivities. What killed his nomination, though, was that one of his supporters, when it came out during the debate, that this might not be the best quality mind, his supporter, a man by the name of Roman Haruska, had been in the Senate for years and on the Judiciary Committee, went outside the chamber after they'd started debating on the Haynesworth nomination and said to one of the reporters who had a microphone there to record for radio, said, "Well, you know, the people who are mediocre, we can't have all Brandeises and Frankfurters and people like that, these great minds. The mediocre people in the world are entitled to a little representation also."
Right.
And, of course, that was the seal of death because he was mediocre, and he went down as a very mediocre selection. And that left the president with two rejections. And he quickly, however, came back with another name from Warren Burger, an old friend of Warren Burger's, by the name of Blackmun, who would be very quickly confirmed by the Senate and indeed take the seat on the court. And actually would also surprise Nixon because and his old friend, he would become much more moderate, if not liberal, than had been expected.
What were they hoping to do with these appointments? What was the political nature of the candidates that they sought? You note that strict constructionists,
right,
was the criterium.
In the book, I have something that I was surprised to find in my files. When I rely on tapes, the Nixon tapes, about 100 Nixon tapes that I used to assemble the book, but I also went through I went through thousands of documents and narrowed it down to about 3,000, and then from those took material. But one of the documents I found in my own files was a definition of what Nixon was looking for on the court. He wanted and had in campaigning in '68 had called for what he called a strict constructionist. That's a term that has been used as recently as the last presidential election when George Bush said that what he was going to put on the court were strict constructionists. Well, I found a definition of a strict constructionist in a memo that Bill Rehnquist had written on Clement Haynsworth to describe he was a strict constructionist. But what struck me was Rehnquist's definition. So we now have a definition by no less than the sitting Chief Justice of the United States as to what a strict constructionist is. And it really boils down to a rather blunt assessment as follows. A strict constructionist judge is a judge who favors criminal prosecutors over criminal defendants and favors civil rights defendants over civil rights plaintiffs. That's a pretty accurate description of what a strict constructionist is. So I doubt that the incumbent president is going to call for strict constructionists, because obviously it is a very biased and not a very good view.
But this is Bill Rehnquist's own construction of constructionists, essentially.
That is his strict construction of what a strict constructionist is, yes.
And that's what they were seeking to appoint to the Supreme Court, deliberately.
It is.
Yeah. Okay.
And Bill Rehnquist is a strict constructionist, I'll assure you.
Yeah. Soon after this, there were two more vacancies on the Supreme Court due to the declining health of Justices Hugo Black and John Harlan. And so President Nixon was presented with two more opportunities to place his own judges, his own definition of what a justice should be, on the Supreme Court. I wonder if you could talk a bit about the screening process. This was kind of a problem because they had no idea who to pick.
Right. This is where what we've really been talking about is pretty well handled in an introductory part of the book.
Yeah.
What we're really talking about now is the core of the book, which is this 34-day drama in which Nixon has these two vacancies to fill.
Mm-hmm.
And as I said, the first one was Dick Poff, that's Act One, where he would fall to the wayside. But another interesting thing that happened very early, and this had been rumored around the White House when the vacancies first occurred, that Mrs. Nixon got involved, and something she never did while I was there or any time I know in his career. But she let the word out that she was going to lobby the president to make sure a woman was appointed. She thought it was past time that a woman be on the court, and so she was putting pressure on the president to select a woman. Well, I also knew, and then got confirmed when I started listening to the tapes, that the Attorney General, John Mitchell's wife, Martha Mitchell, also thought a woman should be on the court. So here were these two men who were going to make this decision, and they're there with their wives putting heat on them, talking about whether a woman or not should be on the court. And they're really very amusing, if not offensive in some regards, but they're beyond offensive. They're outrageous. Where particularly the president, where he has decided that since his wife and his daughters are telling him that it is time, he realizes politically that this is true, that it's a great political plus for him to select a woman. Although he tells his Attorney General John Mitchell, he says, I don't even think women should be educated. I don't think they should vote.
This is an amazing thing. You can hear on these tapes, they have him saying this stuff.
That's right. Well, all of the conversations in the book, excepting some of those which I've reconstructed from memos in my files, in dialogue, are all they're taped conversations, and I have not changed them an iota. Yeah. I've just edited them down to make the story move.
Right, right.
But anyway, that's right. And the one that I was when I listened to the tapes. I must say, one of the things that struck me, Jack, was that the fact that I found myself laughing a couple times. It was so outrageous. When they talk about, for example, Nixon on this subject of women, would tell Mitchell at one point, can you imagine how awful it would be to appoint a woman to the court? It would be like putting a woman in a spaceship with men. And, of course, that's everyday occurrence now, but he just couldn't even conceive this. Mm-hmm. And, of course, as the story moves along, you find that the Chief Justice, Warren Burger, threatens to resign if Nixon appoints a woman. So a woman had real opposition. But anyway, to move the story, after Poff fell aside in Act One, Mitchell and Nixon are scrambling for nominees and that they that point. And they come up with really two candidates from a wide field and a lot of selection and some work by the White House on looking for additional women. But anyway, they focus quickly on two candidates, and they are a bond lawyer from Arkansas, from Little Rock, who, until I'd listened to those tapes, I'd always assumed that Herschel Friday was the nominee of John Mitchell, because they were old friends, and John Mitchell had been a bond lawyer. But that isn't the case. This is another Warren Berger suggestion and recommendation. I just had no knowledge of that, and no one else, to my knowledge, ever was aware of that. The other nominee that they settled down on was a woman by the name of Mildred Lilly, who was a Court of Appeals justice in California. They call them at the middle-level court out there justices. In fact, Mildred Lilly is still alive, and I just talked to her a couple of weeks ago, and she is apparently the longest-serving judge in California now. And she's just as sharp and as quick and as able as I remember her when I vetted her 30 years ago.
Wow, that's great. Well, we'll continue on this vein. I do have a caller I want to include in the conversation. And also, since we're at a point where this would kind of make sense, I'd like to just play a cut of Richard Nixon and John Mitchell discussing Mildred Lilly as a candidate for the Supreme Court. And we'll continue to talk.
Good.
She's a Catholic.
That's great.
Yes, sir.
That's great. And she got a little Italian blood?
Not according to the rhetoric, but it may be. She's sure got a distinguished-looking Italian husband, though.
And he's a lawyer.
Yes. He is just what you would want a judge's wife to be. He's a plotting mediocrity. And rather distinguished looking, you know.
Is he a lawyer?
Yes, a lawyer, and practiced for 35 years out there with that great distinction.
Right.
So that nobody's going to accuse him of influencing the judge's decisions.
Right. Good.
And so far as we can see, he checks out all right. He's been in debt a little bit with some notes at the bank, but he seems to have paid them off and have a reasonably good standing in the community.
Mm-hmm.
So
good.
So far it just looks great, and she's been reversed enough by the Supreme Court in California in criminal cases to give her a good standing with the law and order people.
Good, good, good.
She's got a good personality, I think. People will see that she's not one of these frigid bitches, you know.
That's right, I know, the terrible ones.
Yeah.
Well, this business of by the Catholic thing ends very good, married to an Italian. Okay.
So far, so good, and hopefully we will have a package for you to approve to send to the bar here in the next day or so.
Good. Fine, John.
So that we can keep on target next week.
Great. Very good.
All right. Richard Nixon and John Mitchell discussing Mildred Lilly. The thing I found remarkable about that, besides the reference to frigid bitches, was that they seemed to be concentrating more on who her husband was rather than who she was.
Well, what had happened when the and what would happen also when the name was first surfaced, a lot of the attention would focus on her husband as the first woman, and when I vetted her, I didn't think that he had any problems at all, and I don't think ultimately he would have. And the Department of Justice pretty well checked that out by that time. But she was obviously that was her second husband. Her first husband had died, and she was and is a remarkable woman. And she obviously was somebody who had her own mind and had been dealing with men and lawyers all of her life, and as you noted from that conversation, they were setting it up to send it to the bar.
Mm-hmm.
The reason that Mildred Lilly is not sitting on the Supreme Court today is because of the bar committee was made up of 12 men, of which 11 said that she wasn't qualified to sit on the Supreme Court, although she was the most qualified woman in the country to sit on the court.
Mm-hmm.
In essence, they were saying no woman in the country is qualified to sit on the Supreme Court. It was a pure male chauvinistic decision that prevented Mildred Lilly getting on the court. In fact, a decade later, when Sandra Day O'Connor was nominated by Ronald Reagan in 1981, I pulled together both of their credentials, and Mildred Lilly was every bit as qualified, if not in some regards more qualified, than Sandra Day O'Connor. And as I say, but Ronald Reagan, one, had made a decision not to get pre-approval from the bar, and two, a decade had passed, so times had changed.
We have a couple calls to talk with. I'll include them in our conversation. Let me just mention once again our guest during this hour, Focus 580, is John Dean. We're talking about his latest book, The Rehnquist Choice, The Untold Story of the Nixon Appointment That Redefined the Supreme Court. There's a lot more ground to cover. We'll try to do that in the remaining time. But let's include some callers. We'll go first to listener in Urbana on line number one. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Thank you. I'd like you to comment on earlier descriptions of Powell and Rehnquist in the book The Brethren by Armstrong and Woodward. For Justice Powell, somebody told him he got confirmed because they thought he would die young, even though he was a moderate. And his description of, their description of Rehnquist was that he was very conservative, but so smooth about it that he didn't offend people. What's your feedback on that?
Well, I actually cite the Brethren at one point in my own book. I'm very familiar with the book. I'm very familiar with Bob Woodward and Scott Armstrong. They're friends. As far as Powell, one of the things you'll find in my book that is really quite remarkable is how hard Nixon had to work to convince Powell to take the seat. And what happened is that Powell believed that he was shouldn't take the seat because he was losing his eyesight. He was going blind, and he thought it would be less than forthcoming to, you know, if he didn't know if he could sit there more than 2 years or how many years. Of course, he would sit there over a decade. But there was, to the contrary, he was considered the real prize when they convinced him to take the seat. And there's a great conversation where Nixon and Powell, which I did almost no editing whatsoever, just because I thought it was important to not do any. You'd even boil it down, excepting when he gets very repetitive at the end, where he convinces him or tries to convince him to take the seat. So that is not quite a correct bit of rumor out of the court that Woodward and Armstrong picked up. As far as Rehnquist, no question, he was smooth. We're not in this in this conversation or on this broadcast can be able to get to all of the reasons on how at the very end of the story and only hours before Nixon appoints Rehnquist, does Rehnquist himself learn that, nor will I have time or I want to spoil the story as to how my fine hand was involved in getting Rehnquist on the court and something for which I have many second thoughts. In fact, I opened the book by saying that I have some regrets about it, and for that reason, the least I thought I could do was tell the full story.
I'm glad you did.
I'm sorry?
I'm glad that you did.
Thank you.
Thanks very much for the call. I want to try to get to at least some of that, as you say, without necessarily spoiling the story. But we've got some other callers, and I will defer to them. Let's go next to a listener in Sullivan on line number four. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Very good program. Curiosity, when I watched the Senate hearings on the trial there in Watergate, how are you so well prepared? I mean, it seemed like bing, bing, bing. I mean, just like an ongoing story. And also, Martha Mitchell, discuss her a little bit, your feelings and what you think ever happened to her. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, as far as the Watergate hearings go, I was really testifying to what I knew firsthand, and when you're telling the truth, it's you don't have to keep dragging the bushes around and keeping your story straight. I just told the way I remembered it. Now, I was denied access to my files in those days, and boy, I just realized how much more I could have said had I had access to my files. Now that those files are available, and I was back in them during, for example, this effort to write this book. On Martha Mitchell, I actually tell a couple funny stories about Martha in the book, The Rehnquist Choice, because she was very much on John Mitchell's case, and as well as the president. She The president once told Martha that if he found a good woman for the court, let him know. And she thought there were a lot of good women. Whatever happened to her is, you know, she had a sad problem. She had a drinking problem, and when she was three sheets at night, she'd often call the press and talk to them, and sometimes she was correct, sometimes she was not correct. But she was a lovely lady, an outspoken lady. I enjoyed her. I thought she was fun. I do appreciate the fact, though, that alcohol was not very good to her.
I thought you'd be an interesting person to know. Very good program. Thank you, Neil.
Thanks a lot for the call. Just following up on the early question about Bill Rehnquist and his conservatism, you said at the time that Bill Rehnquist makes Barry Goldwater look like a liberal. And in fact, it was Rehnquist who advised Goldwater to vote against the 1964 Civil Rights Act.
Correct. I had learned that from the senator myself. I'd known the senator for years. Even at that time, the senator's son and I had been roommates in school. Mm-hmm. In prep school, and so I had known him since I'd been about 13 years of age, and I was still in my early 30s then, so I still had known the senator for a number of years. And while in law school, I'd gone up to watch the Senate vote on a lot of votes. I went to Georgetown to law school, actually another senator's son and myself, so we got pretty good seats in the gallery. And one of the votes I'd watched was the 64 vote when Goldwater was running for president. And the vote on the 1964 Civil Rights Act was a very important vote. And years later, it came up and he and I were talking, and he regretted that vote, that he had voted against the bill. And I asked him, well, how'd you happen to vote against it? And he said that he had been advised that it was unconstitutional by a lawyer he respected, and that was Bill Rehnquist. So there's no question that now that we have had a chance to study Rehnquist and see how he reacts, that he is far to the right of most people who Nixon was considering who were rejected because of their civil rights record.
We have a couple callers waiting and just about maybe 7 minutes left. I want to try to include as many people as I can, so let's go next to a listener in Bloomington, Indiana on line number two. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hi. About strict construction and loose construction of the Constitution, Mr. Dean's quotation of Justice Rehnquist implied that the definition of a strict constructionist is one who judges according to his personal subjective prejudices. Mr. Dean, let me run another definition by you and for your comment. I think a strict constructionist, and this is not... This is something that has been known in law for quite a while. A strict constructionist is much more objective, really, than a loose constructionist.
Oh, I don't disagree with that. In fact, there's more to this discussion on strict constructionism than the definition I've given.
Yeah, I think so.
And Nixon himself had a very extensive definition where he relied in his best example of a strict constructionist was Felix Frankfurter. But what's interesting, when you rely on Felix Frankfurter, he's also written that a judge is not capable of making any determination without putting his own feelings into it. So that somehow you can't purely just read the language of the law and know what it means.
I hope the last caller will forgive me. We're really running short on time, and I have some other calls I want to try to include. We'll go next to a listener in Clinton, Iowa, on line number one. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Thank you. I've in your discussion about Rehnquist's views on civil rights, I've got a question about the confirmation hearings. I believe it was for Rehnquist being the chief. There was some testimony from a California attorney, a member of a prestigious California law firm, that he recalled Rehnquist in the Arizona elections. I'm not clear if it was 64.
No, the listener has a good memory.
And, good.
And I tell that story in the book. It's a very dramatic story that happens during the hearings where he is being challenged because he's challenged voters. In fact, one of the, if you will, what we learn from the way Rehnquist was selected is dealt with in a section I call the afterword of the book, and it's sort of the consequences of Nixon selecting him in the last minute. And he was never vetted. He was no one ever checked his background, no one checked his civil rights record, and the fact that he had challenged voters came up in his hearing both in 71 and 86. In 86, they are making the point that he indeed lied in 1971 when he testified about this. And the witness you're talking about is a man by the name of James Brosnahan, who is a former assistant U.S. attorney in Phoenix who had been called out in an election in the mid-60s in Phoenix and found Rehnquist challenging voters. And he really put the lie to Rehnquist on this question. So you have a very good memory of those events.
Thank you very much.
Thanks very much for the call. We just have about 3 minutes left, and I want to make sure that we talk. There's a lot more we're not going to be able to get to, unfortunately.
In the book.
Yes, that's right. And I, again, the Rehnquist choice is the book. But I wanted to ask you to talk about the announcement of these two candidates, Lewis Powell and William Rehnquist. On the day that they were announced, it was successfully kept a secret from the press, and it was a very difficult thing, apparently, to keep secrets around the Nixon White House or perhaps in any White House. But in any event, the candidate, Rehnquist, didn't know until the day that he was announced that he would be a candidate.
That is correct. And he was never, as I say, he was not vetted. And that's the problem and the moral of this story, and one of the reasons I think it's important and is a timeless story, because it shows what happens if you don't go through the full process. It's something I'm sure that could have been prevented. There's nothing in the vetting process would have disqualified Rehnquist from sitting on the court, but it would have prepared him, and he, I'm sure, would have answered many questions differently, where he gave some rather rash, if not indeed concocted answers that were not true, and left himself with a record that is going to haunt him into history. I wasn't the only one to find, one of the other things that surprised me, I wasn't the only one to reach this conclusion. I had instinctively known it at the time of the 71 hearings. I had some of those things he was saying didn't pass the smell test. And when I studied the 86 hearings, I found that the Senate had really focused on his 71 hearings to show that he had lied, and yet the Republicans controlled the Senate, so they just pushed the vote on through, and he was confirmed. But he's now, as a number of academics have looked back on this record, realized that it's pretty clear that he had lied about several things during his confirmation hearing, and that's a rather sad commentary on the highest judicial officer of the country.
Well, I'm sorry to say that we're here at the end of our time. There's much more in the book, so if you'd like to learn more, you should look for it. It is entitled The Rehnquist Choice, The Untold Story of the Nixon Appointment That Redefined the Supreme Court, published recently by the Free Press. And also, there is a 5-CD collection audio version of the tape, also entitled The Rehnquist Choice, and they're both by our guest, John Dean. And Mr. Dean, thank you very much for talking with us. It's been very interesting.
Pleasure. I like your neighborhood down there.
All right. Well, thank
be well.
Thank you. You too.